May it please the court, my name is Dana Weiss, registration number 36656, and I represent Ms. Harris. Today I'd like to focus on the second issue contained in the briefing. If I'm able to, I would then also like to address the first, but we'll see if we can get through the second first. It is a basic principle of criminal law that defendants are guaranteed a fair verdict, free from the influence or poison of evidence, which never should have been admitted in the first place, which arouses the passions and the prejudices of the jurors, and destroys the fairness and impartiality of the jury. Ms. Harris's case is a case of competing expert testimony. SH had a history of sensory and coordination issues which caused him to fall a lot. A month before the incident leading to his death in this case, he fell, he suffered a subdural hematoma, and he continued to suffer the effects of this accident through continued seizures. Ms. Harris was told not to bring SH to an emergency room for every seizure, and she was specifically instructed to call only if they lasted for more than 5 minutes and to let SH sleep after any seizure. At an appointment after his initial accident, medical providers noted that SH continued to have problems and he appeared even to be getting worse. It was in this context that a month later, SH had another fall and another seizure and ended up leading to his death. He presented with no obvious outward injuries, meaning no fractures to the head. He appeared to be have some sort of injury to his brain, but there were no outward injuries that you would expect with a massive violent force being applied. Thus, this became an issue or a case of dueling expert medical opinion regarding the cause of SH's death. Expert testimony by the state indicated that the doctors believed that the injuries were the result of non-accidental trauma. But expert testimony by the defense indicated that these injuries were the result of his prior injury, the prior fall that was through no fault of Ms. Harris's and was caused by one of his more recent falls in the weekend leading up to that emergency room visit, which were testified to by his parents and people who had observed him falling. Again, he was constantly having these problems with his sensory and his motor skills. And then he showed up in the emergency room. The defense expert believed that the injuries observed to his brain ultimately were caused to the injury that had occurred a month prior, and then basically through the reviving of SH later when he showed up in the emergency room, that aggravated or made it worse, the ultimate hematoma that was found. In this context, it is not surprising that the prosecution sought to introduce other evidence that paint Ms. Harris as a bad person with an uncontrollable, explosive temper in order to persuade the jury that she likely acted in conformity therewith, with that picture that they were painting of her. But there was absolutely no relevance, no proper evidentiary hypothesis which justified admission of evidence that 2 years prior to this incident involving SH, 2 years prior, she had become involved in an altercation with her other daughter's father's girlfriend, LL's father's girlfriend, who he had cheated on Ms. Harris with this other woman. This other incident occurred 2 years prior. It involved an adult woman, and it stemmed from a history in which her daughter's father had cheated on Ms. Harris with this other woman involved in the altercation, and this other woman had begun calling Ms. Harris's cell phone number, believing that LL's father had met her at the club. Thus, this was an emotionally charged, highly provoking situation. And this also involved significant emotional history between these two adult women. And this woman showed up at Ms. Harris's house and there was a confrontation. And this prior act bore no resemblance whatsoever to the alleged incident with SH in this case.
Counsel, did the fact that there were children involved in the automobile at the time, does that make it more relevant?
I do not believe so. Again, this was an incident or an altercation directed at this other adult woman. There were children in the car. There was no testimony concerning any actions directed toward them. And in fact, there was no harm to anybody, the adult woman or the children involved in this case, other than there was an allegation that as she drove past her mother, she may have ran over her foot. But aside from that reference on accident, aside from that reference, there was no harm to anybody involved in this case. It involved two adult women. Never were the children the focus of this altercation between Ms. Harris and this other woman. How this evidence could possibly have been relevant to a material fact in this case involving a charge that Ms. Harris engaged in child abuse resulting in death is not at all clear. And the trial court failed in its gatekeeping function in ensuring that a fair trial was afforded to Ms. Harris in this case, and that only relevant non-prejudicial evidence would be admitted. Its only relevance was contingent upon this prohibited purpose of demonstrating that Ms. Harris had a bad character and she likely acted in harmony of it. And under all of the case law, that is the prohibited purpose and that precludes evidence of this sort coming in at all. The danger is too high that the jury will misuse this evidence and that it will prejudice the defendant. As this court is aware, to be admissible, such other acts evidence to be admitted at trial, it has to be established that the defendant committed the act, that it relates to a material fact, and that it has logical relevance, and that that logical relevance is independent from that prohibited character, propensity, purpose. And that the probative value may not be substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. That's what the courts have established. It's established through 404B, Usum, Kaufman, all of the Supreme Court cases addressing this issue would find that the evidence presented in this case, specifically the evidence presented as it relates to this other woman, should never have come in.
Counsel, I'm hoping that you will address harmlessness.
Sure. And before I get to that, I also want to address, it was not just this particular instance, although I do think that this is the most egregious. I also believe that the evidence presented as it related to the cut over SH's eye, that was another act that was admitted. That was improperly admitted because it was never established that Ms. Harris was responsible for that. In fact, it was found to be an unfounded allegation through social services. As well as the allegation that OW was told to hit SH on a different occasion, and at trial he was unable to testify that that did indeed happen. The harm from this irrelevant and highly prejudicial evidence, I think I got to it at the very beginning, which is that this is a case of conflicting medical expert testimony. There was significant differences in terms of the testimony presented as to what caused SH's death in this case. And of course, Ms. Harris always maintained she did not cause the death of SH in this case. She's not responsible for any child abuse that morning. And so the fact that they presented this testimony was specifically to paint her as somebody with an explosive temper and to discredit her testimony and her position that this was caused due to SH falling that morning and through no fault of her own, and that she did not do anything that would have resulted in any injury to SH's head. And that's the harm here, really, because this was not a case where there was overwhelming evidence that the injury to SH was caused by any act by Ms. Harris. And in fact, the state's own testimony, doctor's testimony in this case, indicated that SH, first of all, was immediately taken to the hospital once he was not waking from the seizure that he had had that morning. But again, there was no corroborating external injuries to SH's head that would have indicated that there was a throwing of SH down the stairs or a banging of his head somehow. Additionally, the evidence disclosed that upon arrival at Children's Hospital, they took a CAT scan of his head and there was not a significant subdural hematoma observed by the doctors there. And in fact, one of their experts even testified that you would, if somebody were to be subjected to massive force trauma, and this goes again to the first issue in this case, if a child is subjected to massive force trauma that would normally lead to a subdural hematoma, you would expect to see that right away. SH was a child who had pre-existing conditions and was continuing to have seizures, had had this prior subdural hematoma, and that was resulting in continued problems with him having seizures and with his brain bleeding. The state's expert testified that you would expect to see that subdural hematoma right away, and that it was concerning to him, as was corroborated by the defense medical expert, that there was no subdural hematoma observed in that initial CAT scan. It wasn't until after they had inserted the ventricular drain or tube and started to release the pressure and had also been trying to revive him that they later do a CAT scan and they see that there's a subdural hematoma present, the significant one. But that was much after his arrival in the ER. That was taken at 3 o'clock approximately in the afternoon that day. That's not consistent with massive violent force.
May I ask you a question? In light of the alternative special findings that the jury made with respect to one, Ms. Harris perhaps causing the injury to SH, or secondly, that she placed the child in a position that posed a threat to his health, what, if any, role do you think those alternative findings play as far as harmlessness?
It's a difficult question, and I think that it hits on issues number 3 and 4 in the brief, because the trial court did instruct the jury that they had to unanimously agree upon one of the two theories of guilt, essentially, but it's unclear what they found, what the jury ultimately relied upon. And that goes, again, to the fact that if they were relying upon that she caused the injury as opposed to failed to take SH to the hospital right away, there was no unanimity as it related to what acts specifically they were relying upon. I think that it certainly is plausible that they did find that she, the alternative theory is the court suggests that she failed to take SH to the hospital, and that that may have been their theory or basis of their finding of guilty in this case, but we don't know that for certain. So we can't say that there is harmlessness in this case because we don't know that that's the theory that they rested upon. They certainly could have found the alternative theory in this case, in which case this certainly was harmful. And even assuming that the court or that the jury did find as to the other theory to support its verdict, I still think when you start introducing that type of evidence, which distracts the jury from the evidence at hand, which is what happened on this incident or in this incident, what happened the morning that SH was brought to the hospital, what happened to cause his death and these injuries. And then you start introducing, well, what we do know is that Ms. Harris had these prior incidents involving an adult woman and such. It distracts the jury, it misleads them, and it may even result in a compromised verdict by the jury. And so, again, when you have a case that's as close as this, where you do have, it's almost akin to a civil medical malpractice case, the injury to Ms. Harris's right to a fair trial is significant when you introduce this type of evidence. And I see that I only have 49 seconds left. I'd like to save the rest of my time.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I will go ahead and focus my comments initially on the 404B evidence as well, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you have with regard to any of the issues that are presented. With regard to the other act evidence, I want to point out, first of all, that we're talking about three incidents, which comprise approximately 33 pages of a almost three-week trial. So we're not talking about substantial amount of evidence introduced. We're not talking about numerous witnesses. I believe the other than the car incident, the other two incidents came in through witnesses that were testifying about this crime itself. So we're not talking about a substantial amount of evidence. We are also not talking about any evidence that was belabored during closing arguments. And I'll talk about that a little bit more when I go to harmlessness. But in reviewing the closing argument, the car incident wasn't mentioned at all. And the two incidents, the one involving the cut over the eye and the other one involving OW's statement that his mom said to hit the victim, those were only briefly discussed, and they were only briefly discussed in the context of explaining the defendant's general attitude towards the victim in this case, which was a significant aspect of this case.
Ms. Hanson, may I ask you a question? You said in closing argument that there wasn't reference to these. However, the car incident was used during the defense case in order to attempt to impeach the testimony of the defendant's sister when she testified related to whether she was a good mom to SH and the other two children, correct?
I trust your recall. I'm sorry, it was a very long record. I don't specifically recall that, but
okay.
That sounds good.
So it overall it was used or referenced in a relatively short time frame during the entire course of the trial. Do you think it's significant that it came up again, however, right towards the end of the trial in order to impeach the testimony of Ms. Harris' sister?
And you said it was elicited by the defense?
No, it was elicited. The prosecution questioned Ms. Harris' sister about the car incident in order to attempt to impeach her opinion that she was a good mom to SH and loved him and her other two children.
Well, I certainly don't think that the use of the evidence in that manner, I mean, it's not been argued that that was an improper use of the evidence. It wasn't mentioned at all during closing arguments, so it wasn't improperly emphasized. So I don't think it probably had much impact at all, even if it was mentioned again in that context.
Okay.
And I think, you know, of course, the defendant's arguments here are that it was inadmissible on its outset because it was not relevant, because it was not substantially similar. And I'd like to talk briefly a little bit about the case law in this area, because I realize that we have a case, the Casillas case out there involving child abuse with prior acts evidence, where the court found that the prior acts evidence was unlawfully allowed, found that there was harmless error. And I think the Casillas case is particularly helpful with the harmless error argument here, because in Casillas there was much more evidence of abuse that was introduced, and that was determined not to be warranting reversal. But the Casillas analysis that was used, I believe, has essentially been questioned in the Jones case, the Colorado Supreme Court case in Jones. Because in Casillas, what the court did was basically said that this evidence was offered to show mental state and intent, and then cited a treatise only for the theory that there's only these four rationales for allowing prior abuse acts to show mental state or intent. The first three they listed talk about kind of gaining knowledge from the prior incident that you then used in the second, kind of more like a res gestae type of theory of relevance. And the last was doctrine of chances. And the court noted that there was no argument that the first three were being used there, so we had to analyze it under doctrine of chances, even though that wasn't argued at all below. Court went on to analyze it under the doctrine of chances theory and found that it was inadmissible because it wasn't sufficiently similar. We would ask that this court not follow Casillas. I think Casillas unfairly limited the rules or the theories of relevance to those four grounds. I think Jones tells us doctrine of chances is but one theory of relevance. Certainly doctrine of chances requires similarity, but it wasn't relied on here. It wasn't relied on in Casillas, and it wasn't relied on in Jones. And so simply relying on the lack or the existence of similarities is not critical here. What we have here is essentially a pattern of conduct on the part of the defendant, and this is the reason for why the evidence of the other car incident was offered. Basically, when she gets angry, when she gets frustrated, which she did in this case towards the other woman in the car, she acts out on those angers and those frustrations, but in doing so, she disregards the risk to the children that are present. And I think it's the existence of the presence of the children that is critical in this case. It shows that she was willing and fine with acting out her anger towards this woman. She rammed her car, I think, multiple times. There was an infant, and the defendant's own daughter was in the back of the car, at least there was evidence of that. And she kept doing it.
Was there evidence that in the prior incident, the defendant knew that the children were in the car that she was ramming?
You know, I don't recall specifically.
Wouldn't that matter?
I think that there was, but I can't cite to anything because it was offered to show that when she does this, I mean, her daughter was in the car. Again, I do believe that there was evidence of this, that she knew that. I think she was coming over to the house. There was two children in the car. It was her own daughter, and then I believe it was an infant child, perhaps, of the other woman. So certainly, yes, that would matter.
So please help me understand why that wouldn't be propensity evidence, just propensity evidence.
Well, I think it's pattern evidence. And propensity evidence in and of itself, and I know I'm going to probably ruffle some feathers here, but propensity evidence in and of itself is not inadmissible. It's the using a person's bad character to show that they acted in conformity therewith. Propensity evidence can include pattern of conduct. He has a propensity to commit a sex assault in a similar way. We see this a lot with sex assault or robbery cases. And basically, if you can show a demonstration of a pattern of conduct, it can show multiple things, such as identity, motive, common plan or scheme, things like that. And so I think what we're saying here, I'm not saying that this was propensity evidence, I'm just saying what it showed was a pattern of conduct. It showed she would get angry, and she would act out on that anger, disregarding the safety of children that were present. And it basically made it more likely that when she got angry in this case, she disregarded the risk to the victim as well.
Ms. Hansen, I need to follow up then with you, because you're saying that sometimes propensity evidence may be admissible, but here it wasn't admitted as it was in Jones for common scheme, plan, or design. It was admitted for mens rea and absence of mistake. Do you think that's significant, that there?
No, because there's multiple ways to show absence or, I'm sorry, mental state. In fact, even in Casillas itself, it recognizes that even dissimilar acts can show intent if there's kind of a pattern of conduct. In Jones, they specifically talk about recognizing in wrath you have a pattern of conduct that can show mental state. So certainly a pattern of conduct can show other things such as identity, motive, things like that. It's just one way in which it shows intent.
Where in Jones does it talk specifically about the evidence being used to show mens rea of the defendant?
I'm sorry, if I said that I misspoke. I didn't say it was offered to show mens rea. I said they recognize that it's okay to show a pattern of conduct and that similarities are not always required. In that case, it was not offered to show necessarily mens rea. In this case, it is. But there's multiple different ways to show intent, motive, and certainly motive is relevant to intent. And so what you have here is a woman who is charged with knowing and recklessly causing injury or death to her child, and in a prior incident, she acted out on her anger, and in doing so, knowingly and recklessly caused the two children in the car to be endangered. Certainly the result wasn't the same, but it showed a pattern of conduct. And that pattern illustrates her mental state. And all I'm talking about with the case law, basically we don't have any case law that's on point factually. What I was attempting to do was talk about Casillas and explain why this court should not follow Casillas and limit itself to the four theories of relevance, because essentially there's no support for that, and the Supreme Court has rejected the theory that you're kind of left with doctrine of chances. Because I would agree, I mean, there's no doctrine of chances analysis here.
May I direct, I think you're maybe getting to the harmlessness issue.
Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear your
absolutely.
Comments.
And I'd like to mention too briefly that the other two acts are not essentially being challenged and weren't challenged in the briefs on relevance. They were basically argued that there simply wasn't a preponderance, and for the cases and the facts that I cited in my briefs, then there was certainly ample evidence to satisfy that preponderance standard, and the court's ruling allowing it implicitly found that. So as to harmlessness, I think Casillas is actually instructive in that, as a frame of reference, in that there we have multiple acts of actual child abuse against the defendant's, I think, other child. I think the victim in Casillas was his stepchild or girlfriend's child. And the court found it was inadmissible for multiple reasons that really aren't applicable here. But the court found that it was harmless for multiple reasons that are applicable here. One in which it was, and I disagree that with the defense on this point, I don't think this was a close case at all. We had multiple prosecution witness experts that were very compelling, basically unequivocally saying that the victim died from the injuries that were caused by this blunt force trauma, and there was substantial eyewitness evidence in this case that the defendant caused those injuries.
Are you referring to LL and OW?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, and that's what's different from this case and a lot of these other cases. This is not, I don't think, a shaken baby case, but it's similar. And in a lot of those cases, the problem is you've got the diagnosis of shaken baby and the cause of death based on that, where you have no eyewitnesses. Here we have somewhat dueling experts, although I would argue that their expert was not particularly helpful, because he basically, his cause of death theory wasn't even based on the defendant's own version of the events. And so you don't really have a competing experts situation here. You also have substantial...
Can I interrupt you, though?
Sure.
Didn't he specifically disagree, though, with the prosecution experts and say that, in fact, this was not an incident involving non-accidental trauma, and he laid out very specifically what he believed happened, which was inconsistent with their expert opinion?
Well, and that's why I think that his testimony is not particularly helpful, because in explaining why what he thought happened here, there was no evidence for that. And so his opinion that this is not what happened based on what, you know, the prosecution's theory was and the expert's testimony, but was instead this, when there was no evidence to support this, and there was multiple pieces of evidence to support this, I think just makes his testimony particularly unhelpful.
But if I'm not mistaken, he had reviewed the same medical records, he had reviewed the defendant's statement that she made, and had specifically taken all of that into account in saying that he believed that there wasn't anything in the history that was inconsistent with his opinion, correct?
That may have been his opinion, but I mean, that's completely contradictory to the evidence that was presented at trial.
Specifically, what evidence are you referring to?
Well, her statements to the police and her statements that the victim did not have a head injury that morning, did not have a substantial seizure that morning, and basically her testimony that he had two very brief seizures, he didn't fall and hit his head, whereas the expert's testimony was he had a substantial seizure that caused a re-bleeding of the brain, but the thing was the re-bleeding, the prior injury was on the complete opposite side of the head from the prior injury, from the current injury. So,
but didn't he testify that it wasn't something that was a strike that morning, it was something that occurred within 48 hours prior to that date?
Correct, and there's no substantial evidence of that either.
Well, when you say no substantial evidence, there was evidence from both SH's mother and father that there had been head incidents. You're just disputing the severity of those incidents?
There was evidence.
The city park incident, and then there was the hitting his lip on the truck and...
Right. I mean, the only incident, I think the one he was relying on was the possibility of what happened at the park. Because I don't think the stairs with the lip, there's no indication that he hit his head. If anything, he just hit his lip. And he didn't indicate he was hurt. But the city park one was someone told the dad that she saw him fall, and the victim himself denied having fallen, and there was no physical indication that it happened. So the victim's dad didn't see it, so we really don't have any evidence that it actually happened.
Okay. Can I ask you, just respond related to the harmlessness issue on the alternative findings of the jury?
Okay.
How do you see, if at all, that those relate to one another?
Well, I think that with that, I'm not sure that, because it's not clear with the endangerment theory, if it was based purely on the delay in medical treatment or if it was based on the causing the injuries, because certainly causing the injuries could satisfy either one, and the arguments basically use both. So it's not going to be clear if the evidence was perhaps harmful as to one theory but not as to the other. I don't think we can say from the jury verdicts that it would be harmless in this case if the evidence was improperly introduced. I think we can look at the fact that the jury acquitted the defendant of first degree murder. And that, I think, is evidence, and I think they talk about it in some of the cases that talk about harmlessness. It shows that they weren't so swayed by prejudice that they convicted based on, passions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Bailiff, would you please add 2 minutes to counsel's time for rebuttal? Thank you.
Thank you. I want to hit on just a couple of points here. First of all, I did want to indicate that there were two witnesses Friday to testify solely to this prior bad acts evidence. It consisted of over 50 pages of testimony concerning this prior bad acts evidence where my client was portrayed in quite a negative light for obvious reasons, as we discussed. So it was a pretty significant testimony. And then the prosecution did cross-examine Monica, the defendant's sister, regarding the prior acts to imply, well, she has this explosive personality, this propensity essentially to explode and lash out when cross-examining the sister in this case. Additionally, I would like to point out that Cassius is directly on point in this case. Not only did it talk about the doctrine of chances, which I think we both agree is not relevant here, because the case, or Cassius specifically addressed that because that case involved the Child Abuse Act, and the prior instances were prior child abuse acts as well. And so that was very much a part of the analysis in that case. But Cassius specifically also indicated that the prior bad acts evidence should have also been excluded for because it didn't relate to absence of mistake or accident either. And that was precisely what it was offered for in this case. And it did not show, it did not have a tendency to show an absence of mistake or accident on the part of Ms. Harris. Additionally, I would indicate that and I just lost my train of thought, so I apologize. And I see that we have very little time, and this is a very large record. But the Cassius case is on point. It rejected that theory that's very much an issue here. And also, Cassius was not dealing with a prior alleged incident involving an act of domestic violence, because the trial court excluded that. And that's referenced in the facts and background information to the Cassius case. The court didn't have to address that because it had already been excluded. And that's what should have been excluded in this case on the same reasoning, because it had no relevance and no purpose in this case, only to deprive Ms. Harris of her right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. So we would ask the court to reverse Ms. Harris's conviction and remand this case for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and arguments. We appreciate you very much. The case will now stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. When counsel have finished.